was to share their thoughts on the topics. You're all very knowledgeable and experienced experts with years of dedicated effort. In my view, the most important takeaway from today's discussion is not to assess how volatile the situation is on Pakistan's Eastern Front, or how the Afghan peace process is unfolding. I think the bigger question before us is how to avoid the situation on our eastern border from getting worse. And I hope that when we leave today, we have a better understanding of why we, as a region, are in the situation in which we find ourselves in. I think it is my opinion, and I've been in public life for about 30 years, it is indeed indiscreet on the part of some Indian leaders to react to the Pulwama attack with abandon and near recklessness. This cannot be due to the ill will created between Pakistan and India during the partition. 72 years on, the event should be behind us. Perhaps it lies partly in the way Pakistan and India view their region. And I'm saying both Pakistan and India. As well as the security model they have constructed, which has led them to believe that it is okay to have volatile borders. I think the two countries must revisit the strategic DNA that has formed over many decades. This time around, Pakistan has come out, in my opinion, more measured and purposeful from the last engagement. Pakistan has prevented a hazardous situation from escalating further. It has also converted international criticism of Pakistan to appreciation of our conduct. There are major questions about why an incident whose tragedy no one can deny that was caused by a young and alienated resident of Kashmir is being put at the doorstep of non-state actors in another country. The young man's alienation was known to the authorities. The human rights violation is well documented. The repeated allegation that the source of the incident lies in Pakistan becomes questionable because every other claim of the Indian government since the Pulwama attack could not be proven. India, which has had considerable diplomatic success in recent years, is risking the credibility it commands in the eyes of the world. As Zahid Hussain, who's lucky to have him here with us today, as Zahid recently wrote in Dawn, the Indian government is attempting to redefine the nuclear threshold in the subcontinent. It is testing Pakistan's capacity to respond without breaking the nuclear threshold. This is because of the confidence India has in its diplomatic prowess and its ability to escape criticism and blame despite its dismal record on human rights in Kashmir. India has again escaped criticism for violating Pakistan's international border, bomb Balakot. I think India's diplomatic success is primarily built on the back of a dynamic and a rapidly growing economy. And I'll talk a bit later as to how Pakistan Pakistan should bring its economic performance into its security paradigm. It is for India to decide if alienation of a large group of people should be dismissed and its responsibility placed entirely on another country. Dissent in Kashmir is a problem that cannot be wished away. Military action against people that India considers its own citizens can never replace thoughtful policies, negotiations, and participation. The next few weeks, I think, certainly until the Indian elections, are important and delicate. So let's see how they unfold. Having said that, Pakistan too has some rethinking to do on many dimensions. Pakistan has offered to build a new kind of bilateral relationship with India. Yet in doing so, we must detail the shape and form of the new relationship. In particular, we have to spell out our future policy on non-state actors. No progress is possible without a clear strategy. But it will not be easy to fix a problem that has festered over many years and which carries the danger of a backlash. But Pakistan must begin its soul-searching soon. We have lost much of the goodwill that we've had before, including in the Islamic world. One question to ask is, why India's voice is better heard in the world than our persuasions? And this is likely, in my opinion, because of the presence of non-state actors. What we now have is a changed world. A country can no longer succeed based on a script written decades ago. New alliances have emerged, and equally, geo-economic compulsions have taken over. One ray of hope is that our leaders are ready for bold action, though it still seems work in progress. But what hurts Pakistan also is the state of our economy and our dependence on external assistance. Only with a resurgent economy and strong institutions would the rest of the world develop an interest in Pakistan again. The task before us is manifold. Stability in the region, especially if Afghan talks succeed, has the potential for major economic benefits, as Ahmed Rashid will explain shortly. Improved relations, we must realize and understand that improved relations in South and Central Asia would bring home to us more benefits of China's Belt and Road Initiative. And at this point, I'd like to shed a bit of light on the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, CPEC as it's commonly known. It's a huge initiative, and a lot of money is flowing in, equity is flowing in, debt is flowing in. Many people don't understand, but not all of that money is the fiscal risk of the government of Pakistan. But risk there is, nonetheless, associated with it, because there is a balance of payment risk associated with it. And one of my concerns so far has been that the highways we are building, or the ports we are building, or the railroad, or power stations, is not going to produce the foreign currency that we need to pay back the dividends on the equity or the capital that came in, or to return the principal of any loan that we're getting under CPAC in foreign currency, or the servicing of the loan. And this is an area where I have definitely advised the Prime Minister that the next step in CPAC very definitely must be the encouragement of the private sectors of the two countries to enter into joint ventures, particularly in export industries or import substitution industries. And that's something that Pakistan must pay a lot of focus on. And I would also go along, and I'll tell you in the end why I'm saying this, I'll also go along and say that the considerable foreign direct investment that we expect from the Middle East, we should keep the same parameters in mind. Historically, Pakistan has had foreign direct investment not in the export areas. And therefore, whenever the foreign investment increases, or the growth that we have had in this country, because we have a low savings rate and therefore a low investment rate. So Pakistan lately, in the last two or three decades, has struggled between 3 to 4% growth, and whenever we have higher spurts, it has always led to a crisis, because the savings and the investment in the country are not there, because concessionary assistance is limited, and therefore we go out and procure expensive debt and base our growth on that. And I can give you many examples. The era of the 2000s, President Musharraf's era, we grew very well, but we ended up with the IMF. Look at 2013, a latest example. We took the growth rate to close to 6%, but again, a balance of payment crisis. And I think that the only way to recover, otherwise this situation will reappear again and again and again, as it has some 20-odd times since we came into existence. We got to rectify the structure of our economy, otherwise our dependence on external assistance or aid or loans will always be there. There's no example of a society or economy succeeding without the state delivering essential services equitably. And if you look at the models of East Asia, or even the last number of centuries, if you look at North America, or if you look at the Commonwealth, or if you look at Europe, the growth has to be inclusive, the growth has to be available for everybody. Whenever it is limited to a privileged class, the country can never sustain a higher growth rate over any prolonged period of time. And that's something for our policyholders to think very carefully. Of course, we must improve law and order. I'm giving you a personal example. I'm pursuing, as an entrepreneur, because I'm not in government service right now, joint ventures with China. And I have some very interested parties, and they are now saying, okay, hold on a bit. You do have a problem with India, and you do have foreign exchange problems right now. And of course, they also have their problems, their trade disputes with the United States. So these things very definitely affect the economic environment in a country. So law and order, obviously ensure progressive revenue collection, equitable access to credit, and all the services that governments have to offer. I have a question to ask. How is it that we build great highways and shiny city underpasses and high-tech warfare equipment, but cannot improve the economy? And the answer I have is, because we successfully complete what we consider our priority, and so far economy does not seem to be our priority somehow. And there are a lot of generals and diplomats and journalists and illustrious citizens, civil servants, of course, how can we miss them, sitting here. And I'd like to make one parting note. If we want to make Pakistan strong, strategically or otherwise, we must have a very definite focus on improving the economy of this country and putting it on a path where it can grow at a rate which is high. I'll give you an example. India for the last number of years has been growing at almost twice the rate of Pakistan. So this extrapolated 20 years down the line, you'll be amazed at the figures you'll see. So any defense planner, any strategic planner of this country, focus on the economy. Make it your priority. Because I just said that when we make something a priority, usually we succeed. Thank you very much.